I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Republican presidential election has moved on to New Hampshire for Tuesday's primary. While the Iowa results are being dissected, it's clear that super PACs are going to play an outsized role this election season. In fact, most of the campaign ads in Iowa were funded by super PACs. Restore Our Future, a super PAC run by former Romney campaign aide, spent an estimated $3 to $4 million in Iowa, and much of that money on negative ads aimed at Newt Gingrich. Here's an example.
Barack Obama's plan is working. Destroy Mitt Romney, run against Newt Gingrich. Newt has a ton of baggage. He was fined $300,000 for ethics violations and took $1.6 million from Freddie Mac before it helped cause the economic meltdown. Newt supports amnesty for illegal immigrants and teamed with Nancy Pelosi and Al Gore on global warming. Maybe that's why George Will calls him the least conservative candidate. Check the facts at NewtFacts.com. Restore Our Future, Inc. is responsible for the content of this message.
Super PACs grew out of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision of 2010, and it's our topic for today's Radio Times. Joining us is Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter for the Huffington Post covering money and influence in politics. He previously worked as the senior writer for the Sunlight Foundation, also covering influence, lobbying, and transparency issues. And Paul Blumenthal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
So is Iowa a harbinger of what's going to happen for the rest of the year in 2012?
That's what it looks like. I mean, in 2010, we really saw some of these independent groups come out of the woodwork just starting to be born, and they spent unprecedented sums in a midterm election. And now we're seeing how that plays out in a primary election where all of these candidates seem to have their own super PAC. Now, some of them are better funded than others, and you look at Restore Our Future, which has reported raising about $12.2 million. It's said that they've raised over $30 million by now. And, you know, they've already spent over $4 million in total and about, you know, in between $3 and $4 million in Iowa directly, solely to attack one candidate, who is Newt Gingrich. And, you know, what you're seeing these groups do is they can step in where a candidate can step out of the way and just run negative attack ads to try to destroy opponents and provide the candidate that they support, or in the case of the general election, the party that they support, an arm's distance from the negativity while, you know, helping beat their opponent.
Would you say they play the bad cop so that the candidate and even the party can play the good cop?
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfectly good analogy that, you know, if you think of a campaign as trying to, you know, build a railway to either the White House or to Congress or the Senate, you know, these are the guys who get in there and blow up the mountains so that the campaign can then go in and lay down the rail tracks.
Now, political action committees, PACs, have been around for a number of decades, and super PACs are described as PACs on steroids. How do they work, these super PACs?
So, basically, super PACs were born out of the Citizens United decision, which allowed corporations and unions to spend unlimited sums of money in elections so long as they are independent, so independent from a candidate committee or independent from a political party. And the super PACs were created by the FEC to allow people to form a group that would only spend money on what's called independent expenditures, which is advertising, on television or radio, grassroots work, direct mail, handing out flyers, all of that kind of stuff, so long as it was independent from a campaign or from a party. And they provided this vehicle to do so. And the super PACs, you can raise unlimited sums, you can spend unlimited sums. The only real requirements is you have to disclose everything, and you can't coordinate with a campaign.
Well, let me pick up on that and pick up on Restore Our Future. We played that ad in the introduction. Restore Our Future has some ties to Mitt Romney, the treasurer of Restore Our Future, general counsel, the person who run it. These were people that started Restore Our Future, worked with Mitt Romney on his election back in, 2008?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. You have, his former campaign lawyer, his former political director, and one of his former fundraisers who, you know, are working on the super PAC. And, I mean, you know, when I say they can't coordinate, this is one of those where they have to be independent, as the Supreme Court said. This is one of those instances where we're sort of playing a semantic game, where independent and coordinate mean one thing in the regular English language, but what we're talking about here are legal terms.
Well,
and these legal terms, you know, there are ways that they can coordinate, and there are certainly ways that they are not independent.
Well, just picking up on that, I mean, I'm assuming they cannot talk to each other to literally coordinate some kind of advertising campaign. But if you work for somebody, you know what they want, you know what they think, you know what their issues are.
Well, yeah, I mean, not only do you know what they want, you know what kind of ads they like, you know what kind of persona they want to put across to the public, and you know who their opponents are just by paying attention to the media and who they think would be a natural opponent. But it even goes beyond that, the amount of coordination that's involved. Like, they can talk to each other. The candidate can even raise money for them. And Mitt Romney has appeared at donor events for Restore Our Future. Now, he's only allowed to technically ask for the maximum of $5,000, which is the limit that the Federal Election Commission puts on the what he can raise for his own campaign. But he could ask somebody for $5,000, and they could write a $1 million check if they want to.
So how much do you think, then, money is going to define this 2012 election season?
Well, I think it already has defined it in Iowa. I mean, you saw the rise of Newt Gingrich. You saw the rise of all these candidates who could beat Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney seems to have a pretty low ceiling in a lot of these states. You know, he's not terribly popular within the party. And one of the keys to his strategy is to knock off all of these other candidates so that he can win with such a low ceiling. I mean, in Iowa, he won with, what, the lowest percentage in the history of the Iowa caucuses, if he even won with the 8-vote margin. Who knows what a recount would actually show. But, I mean, 25% of the vote, 75% of people voted for somebody else. All he needs to do is keep knocking off the people who challenge him, and the best way that that's done is through this multi-million dollar super PAC.
And what are the disclosure requirements for a super PAC?
So the super PACs disclose almost exactly like a regular PAC, which is that they can choose to file quarterly or monthly. Most of them choose quarterly, and you know, they have to disclose their contributions and the donors' names. However, since Citizens United allowed donations to come in from corporations, they can receive a contribution from a corporation, even a shell corporation, or a nonprofit with no identifiable trace to a human being. And, you know, that provides a lot of obscuring information to the voters who are trying to figure out where the money's coming from. And we saw this with Restore Our Future. One of Romney's buddies, a former managing director at Bain Capital, gave a $1 million contribution through a shell corporation called WSPAN. And as soon as he gave the contribution, he shut down the shell corporation so he would never have to file papers putting his name on it. And this was a big controversy last summer, and he eventually had to come out and show that it was him. The man's name was Ed Kennard.
And just picking up on this, I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but we are talking about how campaigns are funded, and going back to the Supreme Court decision, that's a 501c4, right? A nonprofit?
Yes. So those are the nonprofits that can run political ads.
And a nonprofit doesn't have to disclose their donors?
No, nonprofits are protected from disclosing their donors, mainly due to freedom of association grounds. And a long time ago Supreme Court decision that protected the NAACP from having to disclose their donor list to the state of Alabama during segregation.
So if a super PAC gets money from a nonprofit, as you're saying, they don't have to disclose who that donor is?
No, they do not have to disclose anything related to that. And a lot of this traces back to the Federal Election Commission, which governs campaign finance laws and is really just a mess of an agency right now. And they can't issue rules on nearly anything because they're split down the middle on all of these key issues about disclosure. They keep having these 3-3 votes between the Democratic commissioners and the Republican commissioners.
So they're what, stymied?
I think it's worse than stymied. They're more just deadlocked because three of the commissioners simply don't believe that there should be disclosure rules around this. They don't believe that the FEC should be enforcing the kind of regulations that the Supreme Court told them to. Because the Supreme Court and the Citizens United decision did say that, you know, with all of this new money that we're allowing into the system, there needs to be transparency. You know, but I guess they didn't know that there was no transparency to begin with.
I was reading that it's been, I think, since the summer, since July, when there was any kind of super PAC disclosure. And if there is disclosure, it really won't happen until the end of this month. And, of course, that's after the Iowa caucuses and several primaries in the month of January.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's a big issue about disclosure. As I mentioned before, they get to choose whether they file quarterly or monthly. So for PACs, if they file quarterly, that means they only have to disclose two times in an off year, which 2011 was. So that would be in July and in the next January. And they would normally have to file these pre-primary filings to show their money before Iowa, before New Hampshire. But almost all of them just switch their filing to monthly, which allows them to avoid that. And that's what they've been doing. So, I mean, there's so many loopholes that they can jump through to be able to avoid disclosing until the last minute. So, you know, we're going to go through one caucus and three primaries before we know the real identity of most of the donors to these giant super PACs.
Are we talking about corruption here?
I mean, I think that that's what you'll hear from a lot of, you know, campaign finance watchdogs who really pay attention to this kind of stuff, is that they're very concerned that eventually this could lead to corruption. And I think, you know, the biggest problem that you see is in these kind of candidate-centric super PACs, where you have a candidate who's benefiting heavily from these unlimited campaign contributions, these $1 million, $2 million contributions that are coming in. And it's not like they don't know who these people are. You know, they're, and in most instances, they are actually campaign donors, or they're people who are close to the candidate. And, you know, the people giving the money know why they're giving the money. It's both for an ideological purpose and because they want to get something out of it in the end.
And do you think, because there are a number of ways to give to a candidate or a party, that there will be more spending on super PACs than on PACs or people's individual donations to a particular candidate?
I don't know if we've actually seen that happen yet. Campaign spending is still the biggest amount of money that we see in elections. And I don't think that the super PACs and the nonprofits are going to start beating that. What they could do in some races is be able to swamp a lot of that, or be able to let another candidate catch up, or just to pile on, like you're seeing with Mitt Romney, who has the most money in the race, and he has the most money in his super PAC. So he's just really able to, you know, double the amount of advertising that he's doing. I think the biggest worry that people have about these super PACs is just you look at what's going on in the presidential race, and you know that this kind of activity is going to trickle down into congressional campaigns. And you already have, you know, some of these super PACs popping up for congressional candidates, and that's where it gets a little bit more touchy.
And I do want to pick up on that after this very short break, talking with Paul Blumenthal today on Radio Times about super PACs. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. Approximately 12,000 new cases of invasive cervical cancer will be diagnosed this year in the U.S. Because early cervical cancers or precancers often have no signs or symptoms, the Pap test is the gold standard for screening. Catching this cancer early often leads to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
New Hampshire voters have strong opinions about presidential candidates.
You can't trust him. I just saw it in his eyes.
He seems to give answers. The others seem to give stories. I like him.
I'm Melissa Block. On Tuesday, January 10th, voters in New Hampshire will cast their ballots, and we'll bring you results, reaction, and analysis. Live coverage of the New Hampshire primary from NPR News.
Coverage begins Tuesday night at 8 on WHYY.
Starting in 2012, the Sound of Young America will become Bullseye. The same great content, the same great signposts to what's good in popular culture, but now with a name that you're not embarrassed to say out loud. So, the Sound of Young America, Bullseye, starting in 2012.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about super PACs with Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter for the Huffington Post, has been covering money and influence in politics. In fact, before working for the Huffington Post, he was the senior writer for the Sunlight Foundation. And super PACs playing an outsized role this election season, if Iowa is an example. And if you have any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking about money, influence, and politics in this hour of Radio Times. I want to play a section of an ad from Priorities USA. This is a Democratic super PAC. In fact, Jeffrey Katzenberg spent $2 million to help create Priorities USA. This is an attack ad against Romney. Let's listen.
Don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it hit the bottom.
Let Detroit go bankrupt, bankrupt.
When you were governor, Massachusetts ranked 47th in job growth.
I would have favored justices like Scalia and Thomas.
They can invest in things like our stock market or the world stock market.
Paul, that sounds like something straight out of Hollywood.
Well, you know, I think advertisements are sounding more and more like Hollywood movies these days.
Do they work to add, especially negative ads? I mean, I guess perhaps looking at Iowa and look what happened to Newt Gingrich, who went into that caucus back in December looking pretty strong and, of course, came in fourth. Do these negative ads work?
You know, I think that there's conflicting research on whether they work, but I do think that they work in a lot of cases to not only just bring issues up about a candidate, but to help people learn about what the candidate's record is, and sometimes this is, you know, these are deceptive. I think in the case of the Restore Our Future ads against Newt Gingrich, run by Mitt Romney's super PAC, you know, those were pretty much all pretty factual about his record. You know, some of them may have gone over the line, but For the most part, they seemed like some of the more factual attack ads I've ever seen. But they do, to a degree, put an impression in people's minds, and especially in a primary where you have people trying to decide between a bunch of candidates who are, in many ways, very similar.
Who polices these super PACs? Is it the FEC?
It's technically the FEC, but you know, there isn't that much oversight or regulation right now. The FEC is totally deadlocked, even in cases of oversight and issuing of fines or anything. They even deadlock on those kind of cases these days. So there's some degree of oversight, but most of it just has to come from the public and the media.
Now, I noticed, in fact, I'm reading something from Huffington Post. The Montana Supreme Court has put itself on a collision course with the U.S. Supreme Court by upholding a century-old state law that bans corporate spending in state and local political campaigns, a challenge to the Citizens United decision. I believe there's some other states that are also doing the same thing. Do you see this as a fight over super PACs?
I think it's definitely a fight over super PACs you know, just the Citizens United ruling in general. What you see in Montana is you see the Supreme Court up there decided to rule pretty much based on the facts of their state's history, which was once almost entirely governed by a group of corporations and the heads of those corporations. They were known as the Copper Kings back in the early 20th century. And that's why they passed a law to ban corporate contributions and corporate spending in elections. And, you know, they're just saying, here are the facts of our state and our state's history and why, you know, we don't agree with the Citizens United ruling. You know, the Supreme Court is still pretty much the law of the land, and they're likely going to knock this ruling down from the Montana Supreme Court. But, you know, it really showed a different way of ruling on a case than Citizens United, which didn't really seem to deal with the facts and simply dealt with how Anthony Kennedy thought campaign finance laws should work.
In fact, I was reading some of what Anthony Kennedy said. Can you distill that down for our listeners? What was his reasoning?
Well, essentially, Anthony Kennedy's reasoning is that independent expenditures cannot corrupt in any way. That's almost a direct quote from the ruling, that so long as these expenses are being made independently from a campaign, from a party, you know, the corporate funds, the union funds, the unlimited funds do not have a corrupting influence. And that's pretty much the essence of why he overturned the previous Supreme Court decision that banned these kind of corporate and union funds. And, you know, also within that, he said that, you know, this kind of a system requires transparency and will need transparency. But, you know, little did he know that he's then kicking the bucket down to the FEC, down to the Congress to try to pass some kind of new disclosure regime, which they haven't done. Mm-hmm. And so there's no transparency for the nonprofits. There's no way to get transparency for these shell corporations. And it's a really difficult situation when, you know, the Supreme Court decides to basically make up some facts about how this ruling should be implemented without understanding that none of those laws exist already.
Because it seems that the more money you have under our system, the more influence you're going to have.
Well, I mean, that definitely does seem to be the case, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected the idea of imbalance as a reason to restrict campaign funds, to restrict campaign contributions, that, you know, a millionaire has more influence because they can spend more money. You know, this Supreme Court sees restricting a millionaire's ability to spend as much money as they want as a restriction on speech. So I mean, that's pretty much where we are.
And in this country, we see this connection between money and speech. You can't limit speech, therefore you can't limit money.
I mean, that's pretty much the case. The only real reasoning that they've had to limit money in elections, to limit speech, is the worry about corruption or the appearance thereof. And so that's why you hear Anthony Kennedy saying independent expenditures cannot corrupt. Even though, you know, you look at Montana's Supreme Court, they're saying, well, you know, in our history, independent spending has corrupted.
Well, we are talking with Paul Blumenthal in this portion of Radio Times about money and politics. Super PACs, he's a reporter for The Huffington Post, covers money and influence in politics. And we're curious whether you donate to campaigns, donate to individual candidates. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, I do want to play an ad for Stephen Colbert's PAC. And as we all know, he is using this PAC that he created to expose the inherent corruption in PACs. And his PAC is called Americans for a Better Tomorrow. And it features Buddy Romer. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Buddy Romer. God, I wish I weren't in this ad. See, I didn't pay for it. Colbert Super PAC did. And Super PACs are not supposed to coordinate with candidates like me. But because this is an issue ad about super PACs not coordinating with candidates, I can be in it as long as I don't say, for me. I say that argument is just a fig leaf, so super PACs can justify doing anything they want. And they have a lot of money, folks. They built this fake set with fake books filled with real money. Hell, they even bought Colbert a unicorn.
All perfectly legal, Rainbow.
I'm Buddy Romer, and I approve this message. Did you?
To Narnia!
This issue ad paid for by Americans for a Better Tomorrow and approved by Buddy Romer. No money was harmed in the making of this ad.
I love Stephen Colbert. What do you think about that ad, Paul Blumenthal?
Well, I think that, you know, Stephen Colbert's probably doing a better job than anybody in explaining, you know, sort of the insanity of the current campaign finance regime to the American people. And you know, people are paying attention. I talked to Buddy Romer the other day, actually, and he was saying that he now gets stopped, you know, in every airport by people who recognize him from that exact advertisement.
You can use humor to kind of poke holes in something. But, I mean, do you see a legal challenge to super PACs or some kind of a challenge making its way through the court system based on what we're seeing at least so far?
Well, there is currently a court case. It's Van Hollen versus FEC that is going to start being heard next week, I believe, in the district court. here in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really based on it's Representative Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, who was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and also led the way on a bill that would have closed a lot of these disclosure loopholes around super PACs and nonprofit spending back in 2010. This was called the Disclose Act. It failed by one vote to clear a Republican filibuster in the Senate. And, you know, he basically said that, well, if the FEC isn't going to do anything, if you guys are just going to deadlock on this issue, I'm going to sue the FEC and say that the courts need to decide that you guys aren't fulfilling the role that was set out for you by the Citizens United decision.
Interesting. You said you're worried. We've been talking largely about the presidential campaign, but you're saying you're worried about these super PACs, in a sense, trickling down or influencing some congressional races across the country?
Well, I think that, you know, presidential races, there's so much money going on. It's not easy to always see some kind of direct corrupt event happening. But on the congressional level, there's a lot smaller amount of money, and, you know, $1 million goes a long way in just a congressional district. Some of these congressional districts are pretty small with really small media markets, and, you know, $1 million, $2 million that one person could drop in to a race could make a gigantic difference to a lot of these people. And what you're starting to see is these candidate-specific super PACs popping up in districts. I think, you know, one of the more glaring examples comes in a California district where they just had a major redistricting that is pitting tons of Democrats against Democrats and Republicans against Republicans in new districts. And in one case, you have a longtime representative, Howard Berman, going up against another longtime representative, Brad Sherman. And Howard Berman now has these two or three super PACs that have emerged that are planning on helping him maintain his seat in this new district.
Well, let's get to some callers at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about super PACs, money and influence in the political system. And our guest again is Paul Blumenthal. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of the system that we have? Let me see what Laurie from Westchester has to say. And Laurie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
You were having problems with my line earlier.
You're good to go, Laurie. Go ahead.
Okay. My point is that when I donate money to a candidate or to a PAC, I can sort of vote without voting, where I'm not allowed to vote. So, for example, I don't live in Iowa or New Hampshire, but if I were to give money to these PACs, I could influence the elections in those states without voting. And I could even give money to a congressperson who's running for election or re-election in another state where I can't even vote, and I can influence the election in that state.
Well, Laurie, let me see what Paul Blumenthal says. Is she right?
Well, yeah. I mean, anybody can give a contribution to anybody throughout the country, and, you know, we see that increasingly more. A lot of the kind of cross-state contributions tends to be ideologically driven. You know, you see that with someone like Elizabeth Warren up in Massachusetts, where she's very popular with liberals in the country with liberal blogs, and you know, they run a lot of these campaigns where people throughout the whole country can give money to somebody that they support ideologically.
Let me look or quote from something you wrote in the Huffington Post today, having to do with Rick Santorum, of course, having come within at least reportedly 8 votes of Mitt Romney. He's now getting a lot of attention. And you write, behind the sweater vest, the faith, the family, and the self-definition as a congressional reformer lies another Rick Santorum. This Rick Santorum favors big business, curries favor with lobbyists, and helped to bind the Washington influence industry to the Republican Party while serving in Congress. He's served 2 terms in Congress representing the state of Pennsylvania. Is there a short answer to the kind of influence that he had in Washington?
Well, people, you know, there's short memories in politics. And one of these things that happened with Rick Santorum is that, he was part of the congressional leadership structure, both in the House and especially in the Senate. And in his role in the Senate, he helped to participate in something that was known as the K Street Project, wherein people like Tom DeLay, Grover Norquist, Jack Abramoff, and Rick Santorum were involved in attempting to purge Democratic lobbyists out of trade associations and lobbying firms and replace them with hardcore Republican partisans. And, you know, what this was about was trying to create a permanent power base in Washington through the private sector, which ultimately created a new fundraising base among these lobbyists who, you know, were getting these million-dollar paychecks from these trade associations, and then they could help collect client funds to donate to the candidates that they wanted. And, I mean, you saw that in, you know, the most extreme relief with a person like Jack Abramoff, who just basically bilked Indian tribes not only for his own personal benefit, but he made them direct all of their money to, you know, vulnerable Republicans in swing districts or, you know, Senate candidates that he liked or wanted to influence for another lobbying client. And you know, Rick Santorum was involved in that, running a Tuesday morning meeting that he had with lobbyists every week where they passed around, you know, papers explaining new job openings, and they talked about who should fill them and what they should do. And there are even instances where when somebody didn't hire the person that they wanted, they took legislative retaliatory action.
And the fact that he has surprised a lot of people and did better in Iowa than people had predicted, you think there's going to be more spotlight on Rick Santorum?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here's somebody who's flown under the radar for the entire election, and you know, he peaked at the last few days without anybody having a chance to say anything negative about him. So it's no surprise that he's running so high. But you know, I'll see what happens when the Mitt Romney super PAC gets their hands on him.
Well, I'm also curious in the work that you do, because you're talking about a system and we're talking about money, which in certain cases is not disclosed. It's sometimes hard to know where this money comes from. What do you have to do to track it down?
I mean, you know, what you have to do is reporting, I guess, and talk to people to try to find out where the money is going or coming from. You know, sometimes there's some kind of tracing back you can do through documents that are actually available. 990s are a type of document that nonprofits have to file that explain a little bit about where they get their money from, but not very much. But they also, you know, explain who they give money to. So if a nonprofit were giving to another nonprofit, you could be able to trace that. And sometimes that takes you back to a foundation with somebody's name on it.
So you spend a lot of time in front of documents and tracking down facts and figures?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Lots of time on the computer.
And lots of time on the computer. So this is going to be a busy year for you, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. There's a lot of stuff going on this year around money and politics. It seems to be one of the big issues of the election. You know, we're going to see more money spent by these independent groups that have been freed by Citizens United than we've ever seen before. Groups like Karl Rove's American Crossroads and their nonprofit Crossroads GPS are talking about raising $300 million. Mm. You know, the Obama group's Priorities USA are talking about raising $100 million. I don't know if they'll reach those marks, but even just talking about those kind of fundraising figures is just outstanding in that field.
Well, Paul Blumenthal, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. He's a reporter for the Huffington Post covering money and influence in politics. Danny Heitman, waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about talking and listening across the political divide. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA offers art classes and workshops for all ages and levels this spring, featuring Saturday classes for high school students, weekend workshops with renowned artists, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, and classes on location at historic Yellow Springs, Chester Springs Studio. Classes begin January 17th. More information or to register online, pafa.edu/CE.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember singer Barbara Lee. She died last week at the age of 82. We'll listen to her 1991 Fresh Air concert of Cole Porter songs. Also, an interview with Tina Fey. Her book Bossy Pants just came out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest from New Hampshire as the candidates prepare for this weekend's crucial debates. Also, Before Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close was a film, it was a Jonathan Safran Foer novel that looked at 9/11 through the eyes of a 9-year-old. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Do you gravitate to news outlets and political commentators who agree with you, or do you search out pundits and people with a different point of view? Our guest Danny Heitman has made it a habit to listen to the other side and says he has learned a thing or two. He's a columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate, also an essayist for a number of national newspapers, and joins us on Radio Times. Danny Heitman, nice to have you with us.
Good morning, Marty, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Danny Heitman, you talk about being in college and watching, and this kind of dates you here, but watching William F. Buckley on television as a way to, educate yourself about the other side?
Well, quite frankly, Marty, one Sunday afternoon I was bored and couldn't find very much on TV, came across Firing Line with William F. Buckley. What impressed me about the show was Buckley's willingness, even though he was an ardent conservative, to have liberals on his show and to give them free rein, not interrupt them, let them express their views and have civil discourse. That really communicated to me that he was confident enough in his own political views to have them challenged by others, and that really inspired me to start reading editorial pages diligently, sampling both sides of the political spectrum, and I find it's been very enriching for me. And in this recent op-ed for the Christian Science Monitor, I encourage other readers to do the same.
And how would you describe your political beliefs and ideology?
As I mentioned in this op-ed, I'm what's paradoxically called a flaming moderate. I've really, in reading both liberals and conservatives, I've really come to the conviction that neither side of the political spectrum has all the answers, and it's really important for us to consult both sides.
And back in the 1980s when you were in college, were you left or right, or were you also a flaming moderate back then?
My political views were really unformed at the time. I guess if you really had to classify what my thinking was at the time, this was really the high point of the Reagan era. I lived in the Deep South as I still do. But the conversation around my family dinner table included a grandfather who was a New Deal Democrat, a mom who was a Republican. And I guess I really, to the degree that I am politically tolerant, I think I learned about it at that dinner table where we were allowed to express any view that we wanted, and nobody was criticized for that.
I'm thinking about Firing Line and William F. Buckley, and this was a highly intellectual show, very heady discussions, and as you say, he often invited people with very different political opinions from his, but I don't think that exists on TV anymore. Do you?
The only thing that I think approximates that is Book TV, which is on C-SPAN on the weekends. And quick story, my daughter, when she was a very small child, came into the room. She was not yet able to read. And she said, Daddy, are you watching C-SPAN again? And I said, yes. How did you know it was C-SPAN? She said, it's always one person talking for a long time, and nobody interrupts them. And that was so striking to her. That was so unusual to her because she hadn't seen that before on TV. And isn't that a shame?
It is a shame.
But that is so unusual that's how she would identify C-SPAN. But I do think that is a great source for political commentary. They split right down the middle between political and conservative commentators. And they do give people an opportunity to express their views without, cutting them off and getting into all this needless conflict.
I'd like to hear how your daughter describes what's on cable TV these days.
My daughter is a great fan, like many teenagers, of reality TV, and I do think that is a big driver in the decline of civil discourse, because reality TV tends to glamorize conflict, and whether our politics is informing reality TV or reality TV is informing our politics, you do see a political culture in which conflict is glamorized, and I think we need to get back to elevating civility and compromise as really our civic ideal.
But I also think that the people have segregated themselves. You know, they're the people that watch Fox or the people that watch MSNBC, the people that read, you know, conservative newspapers or magazines, liberal newspapers or magazines, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of the kind of crossover that you're calling for.
And it's a shame. You know, this is a time of year when a lot of people are making New Year's resolutions about their diet. And we've heard a lot in recent years about the variety of having a diverse and balanced nutritional diet. And I make the argument that, you know, we really need to have a diverse and rich intellectual diet that doesn't just eat one side of the plate, but you really do need to sample the opinions of other people.
Well, let me see what our listeners have to say at 1-888-477-9499. Do you have a mixed diet, as our guest Danny Heitman suggests? The idea of listening to pundits and people with whom you might disagree with when it comes to politics. He's a columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate, wrote about this issue recently and calling on others to do what he does, which is to try to listen to the other side and be open to other people's ideas, certainly when it comes to politics. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So what have you learned listening to, quote-unquote, the other side, Danny Heitman?
Well, you know, I think that Reverend Joan Brown Campbell really put the finger on it in an op-ed that she wrote for the Christian Science Monitor in 2004, in which she said, being civil to an adversary does not mean sacrificing core principles, because in challenging an adversary, you can separate what that person says from who they are. And that's really important to remember, because I think a lot of people believe that if they do indulge commentary from another side, that then somehow they're going to be sacrificing their own principles. And that's not the case. I mean, you can still have that comfort of knowing that you can have your views challenged, and then you have a choice. You can either choose to change your views, or you can keep them. But nobody should feel threatened by sampling commentary from the other side of the political spectrum.
In fact, you even write, it's even good for you to take your opinions and try them out and defend them and explain them, that it helps people think about what they actually do believe in.
Oh, sure. I mean, I mentioned this great, you know, 19th century political philosopher, John Stuart Mill, and it's a reminder to us that partisanship is not something that we invented, you know, this year. But Mill, you know, he lived in an intensely partisan time himself, and he said there are at least three benefits from listening to the other side. He said, if you consider an opposing viewpoint, you find it's an error, then you have the satisfaction of correcting your own views. If, on the other hand, you determine that somebody else is right or partly right, you have the equal satisfaction, you know, of correcting your opinions. And he said also, you know, you have you might also have the opportunity to change someone else's mind if you listen to them and give them, you know, a forum to express their views. They're going to be more receptive to your own views, and you might actually get to change their mind. So he talked about the great value of civil discourse, and that, you know, there's everything to gain and a lot to lose.
That requires, though, listening, doesn't it?
It does, and listening is an
art.
It's
really hard. It's
it
hard
is.
To do. Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Robert from Orland joining us on Radio Times. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'd love to comment on this. I am an Orthodox Catholic. I'm conservative in many ways, but I ferret out liberal sources that I feel are valid. I want to know about what liberals feel about issues. I want to know why they feel that way so that I can better understand that. And also, it helps me be more intellectually honest when it comes to my own arguments. I love the truth. And I love clarity. And when that breaks down, I know that I need to go look in another direction. And it breaks down on both sides.
Well, Robert, I'm sure you're a man after, or Danny Heitman would be very happy to hear you say what you just said. Let me give him a chance to respond. Danny, go ahead.
You know, I mean, that's great, Robert. And, you know, I get back to this wonderful op-ed that Reverend Joan Brown Campbell wrote in 2004 for the Monitor. And she said, reserve your passions for loving. Speak forcefully to what you believe, and always reserve for yourself the possibility that you might just be wrong.
Mm.
You know, and I think if you have core convictions, you know, they're going to be made stronger by being placed in context with other convictions from other people. And I think that is what civil discourse is all about, and that's really the ideal of being an educated person, right?
And Robert talks about the truth, but you know, it must be said, Danny, that sometimes you listen to things and they're lies. I mean, people are spouting lies.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, again, I think that we're assuming all good relationships are based on shared values. And I think in any true civil discourse, you have to have the shared value that you're going to be an honest actor and you are going you know, you're going to speak the truth as you know it, and not try to be, not try to be deceptive. And of course, you know, whenever you indulge a whole range of views, you are going to have people who are bad actors. But I think on balance, there are enough people of goodwill that we can find common ground.
You mentioned the fact that you find this civil discourse on C-SPAN. Do you watch cable news shows? I'm just curious.
You know, I watch a good bit of CNN, mm-hmm. and I do from time to time watch some Fox News. But I mean, where I really get my diversity of views, I'm really more of a reader than a viewer, mm-hmm. and I really enjoy reading my own editorial page and the page and of course the New York Times and other great newspapers. And I really enjoy reading Richard Reeves, who's a great liberal columnist, and George Will, who's a great conservative columnist. And just as an example, and that's really where I get my diversity of views.
Let me see what Meredith from Chestnut Hill has to say. Meredith, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I'm delighted to hear Mr. Heitman. I lived in Baton Rouge from 1958 to 65, which was a very exciting time down there. And I was violently involved in the civil rights movement, not really violently, but, you know, not physically, but mentally. And I did not want to hear the other side at all, because I was convinced my side was right, being a carpetbagger from the North. Anyway, I have, in my old age, I'm now 78, decided that Mr. Heitman is absolutely right, that there is great value in listening to the other side, if only to come up with arguments against their arguments.
A good kind of mental exercise. Meredith, let me see what Danny Heitman has to say. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Danny, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank Meredith for her hard work on behalf of civil rights in Louisiana. I was born in 1964 in Louisiana, the same year the Voting Rights Act was passed. Mm-hmm. And because of the hard work of people like Meredith, I and my community has been able to benefit a great deal, so I commend her for that. I did want to mention Richard Reeves, the columnist that I had talked about earlier, who was a liberal. He reluctantly, at the urging of a publisher, did a biography of Richard Nixon. He approached the subject with great reluctance, but over time developed a grudging admiration for some of the things that Nixon, of all people, was able to accomplish. Does this mean that Richard Reeves now thinks that Nixon was without fault and was a great president? Not necessarily, but my point is that even when you consult people that you think you would have absolutely no sympathy with, quite often you find that even they have something to offer you that will enrich your moral imagination and your intellectual imagination. And I think that's really the value of reaching out and crossing that divide.
Meredith, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Ron from Drescher has to say. Ron, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd just like to point out, as a social studies teacher, a retired one, I taught eighth graders, and what a challenge it was to help our mostly liberal students understand that there are both sides to a story, especially during an election year, thinking of 4 years ago. Helping kids is just as important, of course, as helping adults. And I like to think that there's a lot of teachers out there that really do try to help kids understand, to think critically, to look at all the issues, Because in general, I think that kids that are interested in politics don't necessarily come into the classroom with a completely open mind. And just as a little anecdote, I couldn't mention President Bush without getting some kind of groan coming out of the classroom. And I think it was really important to help kids understand that you got to respect everybody's point of view, and you certainly have to respect the president. Helping kids think critically, I think, is really important.
Well, Ron, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Danny, anything you want to add to that?
I just wanted to say how ironic that call was, because in my home community of Baton Rouge, we have completely the opposite problem. We have students who are so conservative and often uniformly so that they cannot comprehend why anyone would support President Obama. And so we have completely the opposite challenge. Isn't that interesting? But that's one of the things that I try to communicate to my kids around the dinner table, because they do live in that environment, that there are people who have views that are different from what is commonly held in our neighborhood, and that's okay. That's fine.
We're almost out of time here. Have you gotten a lot of response to your article?
Well, I've been gratified that folks like you have called me and wanted to discuss it. I was on Wisconsin Public Radio a few days ago, and one caller said, I don't know why we're talking about this. This is, just seems so obvious and self-evident. Why would we even have to talk about that? And I said, well, you know, unfortunately, it might seem self-evident to you. It might seem self-evident to me. But if you look at the evidence, there's a lot of people out there that don't seem to be getting that message.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marty, and Happy New Year.
Same to you, Danny Heitman, columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate, and you can read his article. It was published in the December 30th edition of the Christian Science Monitor. And we began our conversation with Paul Blumenthal, reporter for the Huffington Post, covering money and influence in politics. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Mosco. Wayne, thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.